chapter 20. If you'd make your way over there, we've been studying the book of Job these last few weeks. Tonight it is my intent to cover chapters 20 and 21. That will be Zophar's second speech and Job's response to Zophar. So we'll call chapter 20 More Zingers from Zophar. You know, Zophar was not very kind the last time he spoke to Job. So we'll read here tonight that he hasn't lost any of his sarcasm or biting remarks. So, zingers from Zophar. This will be Zophar's final speech in the book, because once we get to round three, Zophar doesn't speak. That's when the young guy jumps in there, Elihu, and he adds his 2 cents. Well, he adds about 20 cents, actually. But yeah, we won't be sorry to see Zophar go. I know Job wasn't sorry to hear the last of him. All right, we're in chapter 20, verse 1. Then answered Zophar the Namathite and said, therefore do my thoughts cause me to answer, and for this I make haste. I have heard the check of my reproach, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer. Knowest thou not this of old, since man was placed upon the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite but for a moment? You know, in these beginning remarks here in his second speech, he doesn't really bring anything new to the table. He rehashes the same old arguments as before. Very little here that he'll say that's new. And his first comments actually answer something Job had said in the previous chapter that Zophar took offense to. He was not very happy with some of the things that Job had said. So that's why he says here in verse 2, your words have disturbed me, if you allow me to paraphrase. Your words have disturbed me, they've irritated me, and now I've got to speak. I've got to speak up right now. I just can't be silent anymore. You've insulted me. That's his what he's saying in verse 3 here. I've heard the check of my reproach. You know, Job is insulting me. He's taking it personally. You've accused me. And I just got to tell you what I'm thinking. I can't hold it anymore. I've heard all of the things you've said, your insulting criticisms. So I'll answer you, he says, what I know to be true. And what follows in these next verses, Zophar declares to Job three things. He's going to make three important points in these next verses that he says this is what's going to happen to wicked people. He's telling Job, this is what's going to happen to wicked people. And as you read this and hear what Zophar is saying, you'll realize these are the things that are happening to Job. So you know what the implication is. This is what happens to bad people. This is what's happening to you. Therefore, you're a bad person. You know, you're an evil person. So here's what's happening. And in verse 4, he uses the old tactic, everybody agrees with me. You know, you ever get in a discussion with somebody and say, oh, everybody says the same thing. What I'm telling you, everybody says this. Here's what he says. Knowest not this of old, since man was placed upon the earth. Everybody knows this. This is common knowledge. Everybody knows what I'm saying is true. Ever since Adam walked the earth from the beginning of time. And what is it that everybody knows? Verse 5. This is Zophar's key. The key verse, I guess you'd say, in his speech, that the triumphing, that is whatever victory, singing, joy, mirth, happiness, the happiness of the wicked is short. The joy of the hypocrite here, this is the wicked person, is but for a moment. The life, the triumphing, the prospering, the happiness, The laughter of the wicked is just for a moment. And that's the first point that Zophar is going to make here in this section of Scripture, that the life of the wicked is brief on the earth. The life of the wicked is brief on the earth. That's going to cover verses 5 all the way through verse 11. The life of the wicked is brief on the earth. They may laugh now, but they won't laugh long. The pride, the haughtiness of the sinner is short. The joy of the evildoer is just for a moment. All of their mirth and laughter will soon cease, and their throats will fall silent. Really, the Lord has said something similar when he said over in Luke chapter 6, "Woe to you that laugh now, for you will weep." But he was talking about those who are laughing in sin, mocking the righteous. There's a lot of people who do that. They did it then, they do it now. They laugh, they're happy, they're full of themselves. And Jesus is saying, "Woe to you who laugh now, you will weep." There will come a day of weeping, even though that day might not begin until eternity, once they step on the other side of this life. And then the Lord had also said, "But blessed are those who weep now, for you will rejoice." Those who weep now, they weep over their sins and over the sins of the world, over the sins of those around them. But just as the Lord was talking about the momentary laughter or mirth of the wicked, that's Zophar's point right here. In verse 6, "Though his excellency mount up to the heavens and his head reach into the clouds," no matter how high in excellence the wicked reach, no matter how far they advance in the things of this world, or they could be promoted to the highest of heights, they can be exalted so high that they, you know, bump their head on the clouds. It doesn't matter, he says, verse 6, even if they get exalted that high, yet, verse 7, "He shall perish forever like his own dung. They which have seen him shall say, where is he?" He's going to decay and rot just like his own stinking dung, and his reputation will come to stink just as he did. All will wonder, whatever happened to him? What happened to that guy? So, you know, this is a zinger that's aimed directly at Job, keep in mind, because, you know, his body has decayed. He is emaciated, a skeleton of a man with his flesh just clinging to his bones. People were whispering about him. What happened to him? What became of him? This guy that was so rich, he had so much. Look what's become of him. Zophar says, verse 8, "He'll fly away as a dream and shall not be found. Yea, he shall be chased away as a vision in the night. The wicked will be forgotten, just like you forget your dream." You know, you can have a really funny dream, profound dream, frightening dream, whatever kind of dream, but when you wake up, you can't remember what it was. So, well, that's what the wicked will be like. They'll just be forgotten. People won't remember them. They won't know who they are. Of course, now this is Zophar's argument, okay? This is his argument. And you know that in a couple of generations, virtually all people are forgotten, wicked or righteous, really. That is, on this earth. You can probably remember your grandfather. I doubt if many of you remember a great-grandfather. So that's just a few generations, and their memory is pretty much gone and forgotten. Unless they were some really famous person that left some significant mark in society. I don't know who my great-grandfather was, my great-great-grandfather, my great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother. Their names forgotten to me. If we researched the family tree, we could find out their names. Some of our family has done that. But anyway, that's Zophar's point. The wicked will will flee away, their memory will be gone, just like your dream is gone when you wake up. And then verse 9, he says, the eye also that saw him shall see him no more, neither shall his place any more behold him. He's here one day, he's gone the next, never to be seen again. You know, it's just no matter how high the ladder of success is that you climb, it just means you fall further when you do fall, as far as the wicked, go. And you know, he goes on, Zophar goes on, he says, and when the wicked fall, and when they perish, all their wealth will perish with them. He says, verse 10, his children will seek to please the poor, his hands shall restore their goods. The idea here is that when the wicked guy dies, he made all of his money, he accrued his wealth by oppressing the poor, and now his kids, instead of being able to enjoy the wealth that the daddy accrued, they're going to have to pay people back that were cheated, that they'll be forced to repay debts and loans and so forth. So they won't even be able to enjoy everything that the father accrued. Verse 11, he talks again about the fate of the wicked. His bones are full of the sin of his youth, which shall lie down with him in the dust. His bones being full of the sin of his youth, the idea here being that while still in the prime of life and what people would think would be health, his sin will not be forgiven. It'll carry with him to the grave, and it'll be attached to him even in his death. You don't want your sin to follow you. You want to be forgiven of sin, right? Well, this is Zophar's argument. His sin's going to be so attached to him that it'll cling to his bones even in the grave. So his argument is that the wicked will not live long on the earth. They'll die young. Second, his argument is their pleasure is going to be short-lived. Their pleasure, their happiness will be temporary. And that begins in verse 12 and goes all the way through verse 19. The pleasure of the wicked is temporary. Verse 12, he says, though wickedness be sweet in his mouth, though he hide it under his tongue. Wickedness is sweet in his mouth. Now he's using taste and tongue and food to make his point here. And what he's saying is that the wicked enjoy sin the way a Cajun enjoys food. You know how it is, you live down in this area, you enjoy food. You think about food while you're eating it. You think about what you're going to eat next or what you're going to eat tomorrow. Well, this is the point that Zophar is making. Though wickedness be sweet in his mouth, they enjoy their sin. You know, Hebrews talks about how Moses forsook the pleasures of sin and chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, because pleasure, sin can be pleasurable, but only for a short time, and you know it comes with a price tag. But what he's saying here is that wickedness be sweet in his mouth, though he hide it under his tongue. Picture this. He doesn't want to swallow it because he's enjoying it so much. You know, like when you put something really delicious in your mouth and you just want it to sit there for a while because you know you shouldn't be eating that. And well, this is the way the wicked enjoy sin. It's like a delicacy. But they only enjoy it for a while. Only for a while. Verse 13, he says, though he spare it and forsake it not, but keep it still within his mouth. He doesn't want to swallow it because, you know, then it'll be gone. But notice verse 14, yet his meat in his bowels is turned. It is the gall of asps within him. It quickly turns bitter in his stomach. It sours in his stomach. No matter how good it tasted in his mouth, once he swallows it, he realizes he swallowed poison. And it's the venom, he says. It's the venom of a cobra, as one version translates it. And verse 15 says, and everything he swallowed, he'll vomit up again. He has swallowed down riches, he shall vomit them up again. God will cast them out of his belly. It's the price of sin. All that he swallowed down, he'll vomit up. The lesson we could say here is that sin carries with it both pleasure and misery. It carries pleasure, but it carries punishment. It can taste good for a while, but it has a price tag. And if you want the one, you've got to accept the other. That is, if you want the pleasure, you've got to be willing to accept the punishment and the misery that goes with it. Like the person that drinks too much and then he's hungover. There are consequences to our actions. Sin carries with it a price tag. And, of course, Zophar is making this point. There's a penalty involved. He says, verse 16, his sins, his choices will destroy him. He shall suck the poison of asps. The viper's tongue shall slay him. He will not be able to enjoy even the simple things, the simple pleasures of life. Verse 17, he shall not see the rivers, the floods. The floods here meaning like bubbling brooks and things like that. The brooks of honey and butter. The simple pleasures of life. The person who gets trapped in sin does not get to enjoy even the little blessings and enjoyments that God provides. And you know that this is true in so many ways. You can become, let's just take a person who is a drunkard. They're an alcoholic. They have a problem with alcohol. They become so trapped in this cycle of drinking that they can't enjoy the normal things that the average person can enjoy, whether it's a good meal, a good conversation. Consider a drug addict. They can't sit down and carry on a good conversation. Their mind's 1,000 miles away, where they're going to get the next fix, where they're going to get money to get the next fix. They are deprived of so many things. The simple pleasures, you get to walk, you get to look, you get to see the birds, the color of the birds, you get to smell the air or whatever. But a person who is trapped in a cycle of sin doesn't even get to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. How many mothers trapped in addiction or other sins didn't get to enjoy raising their children? The laughter of a child, even the crying of a child, you know, to pacify their child, to hug their child, to love their child, to sacrifice for their child. Too busy chasing the next fix or down in another bottle thinking about their sorrows or their problems. And this is true with any kind of sin that traps a person, that holds a person in bondage. They don't get to enjoy even the simple things. Sin robs them. Robs you of your taste for good things, simple things. Verse 18 and 19, they don't even get to enjoy the things they worked for. He says in verse 20, 18 and 19, that which he labored for shall he restore and not swallow it down. According to his substance shall the restitution be. He shall not rejoice therein, because he's oppressed and has forsaken the poor, because he's violently taken away a house which he builded not. He's talking about those who are wicked. They acquire their wealth by oppressing others, by not paying people that work for them, by taking advantage of others, by taking away people's property when they have the ability to do that. There are a lot of wicked people in the world. There are people who will take advantage of the poor. They will use them, abuse them, misuse them. I can't tell you how many people have told me that they worked for people. You know, after Katrina, we had an influx of people who came from south of the border, whether it was Mexico, Central America, even South America. We had people who came from all over to work. And I'm thankful they came. because they did a lot of hard work, and they did things nobody else wanted to do or could do. We just didn't have the manpower to do it. I can't tell you how many of them told me they got cheated out of wages, because they would agree to work for somebody to do all of this labor, hard, dirty, backbreaking work, and then they wouldn't get paid, or they didn't get paid what they were promised, and they really had little recourse because many of them were here illegally. But I want to tell you, there's a God who keeps record of things like that. You know, you oppress the poor, there's a horrible price to pay. The Bible speaks much about those who oppress the poor. Years ago, when I was still in the haircutting business, and I remember a lawyer that came into my shop. I know not all lawyers are like this, but this guy came into the shop, and he had a big smile on his face, and this was a very cunning guy. And so, you know, I said, "You in a good mood today?" He says, "Yeah, I really am. I'm having a great day." I said, "Well, good. Good for you." He said, "Yeah, I got a house today. I took this woman's house who was unable to pay her taxes. So she was unable to pay her property tax, and he got her house at a tax sale. And I think he said he got it for like $300. So here's a woman who's been living in this house all these years, and he's just as happy as he can be because he's going to take this woman's house right out from under her on a tax sale because she was unable to pay her property tax. Now, I did come to find out later that when his wife found out what he did, that she must have threatened him severely, because the next time I talked to him, he said, "No, I had to actually give it back to her." You know, but he said his wife went through the ceiling. Go ahead, bro.
I don't know if you remember in the movie Jurassic Park, there was a scene where the T-Rex ate a lawyer. Like somebody said, it shows T-Rexes weren't all bad.
Well, not all lawyers are like that. Brother Joe isn't like that. He'd have paid for that lady's taxes and gave her the house. Well, he used to be. Yeah. Verse 19, he says, he's oppressed the poor, he's forsaken the poor, he's violently taken away a house that he did not build. The Lord's not going to allow people to enjoy wealth like that. He shall not feel quietness in his belly. He shall not save of that which he desired. You know, the lesson we could say is that sin doesn't satisfy. It never will satisfy. It may dull a person's pain for a few minutes. It may help them to sleep because they obliterate their brain with pills or booze or whatever. But you know, sin never really satisfies. It never brings contentment or happiness. And no matter how much a person acquires, if that's the measure of their happiness, they never quite acquire enough. You know, the famous saying that's attributed to John Rockefeller. Rockefeller at one time was the richest man in the world. He was America's first billionaire. Rockefeller was the guy that was the founder of Standard Oil Company. The richest man in America, a billionaire way back in the, 20s? So here's a guy, I guess his worth today would, you know, he'd be like a Bill Gates type guy. But a reporter asked him one time, "When are you going to retire? I mean, when are you going to say you've got enough?" And his famous answer was, you know, like, "When will you be satisfied?" He said, "I just need a little bit more. Just a little more." Because you're never satisfied. You never quite have enough. Always grasping. Here's what the Bible tells us, that godliness with contentment is great gain. Godliness with contentment. Because, you know, godliness, contentment, what you have here is gratitude. And gratitude makes whatever you have enough. But then the last section of Zophar's lecture really begins in verse 20 and goes through verse 29, where he tells Job, the wicked are going to die a painful death. They're going to die hard. They're going to die a hard death. Verse 20, they're not going to feel quietness in their belly. He will not enjoy what he's got. He's going to have no rest, no peace. His lusts, they'll be unquenchable. Verse 21, there shall none of his meal be left, none of his meat be left. Therefore shall no man look for his goods. The idea here is all that he has will not continue. He's just going to come to ruin. He'll have nothing left of his estate. Now imagine you're Job, and your friend Zophar is telling you, this is what's going to happen to the wicked person. He's not going to have anything left. All that he has, he's going to lose it all. It's all going to come to ruin.
Job lost everything.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what's happened to Job. He's pointing his finger right at Job. This is what happens to the wicked. What does that say about you, Job? His success won't last. Verse 22, he says, sorrow and misery and trouble and affliction are just going to constantly surround him. In the fullness of his sufficiency, he shall be in straits. Every hand of the wicked shall come upon him, shall come against him. When he's about to fill his belly, God will cast the fury of his wrath upon him and shall rain it upon him while he's eating. God won't let him enjoy anything, not even a single meal will be able to bring him pleasure. You know, Job's in a state of absolute misery. Zophar is pointing out that's what happens to the wicked. And there'll be no place to run, no place to hide. Verse 24, verse 25, he shall flee from the iron weapon, and the bow of steel shall strike through him. I think it's brass in other versions, but the idea is you run from an iron weapon, you run from an iron spear, and they shoot you with a bow and arrow. It's a familiar expression. You find it several places in the Bible. Amos talks about the one who runs from a lion and the bear gets him. Or they run from a noose and they fall into a pit. And they climb out of the pit and they get caught in a snare. No place to run, no place to hide. This is what he's talking about here. Verse 24, 25, 26, no place to hide. Gets to verse 27 and says, heaven is going to reveal his iniquity. Heaven will expose his sin. That's what's going to happen to the wicked. Heaven will expose it and will testify against him, and everything will be lost. Verse 28, the increase of his house will depart. His goods will flow away in the day of divine wrath. God's wrath will take everything he has away. Verse 29, this is the portion of the wicked man from God, and the heritage appointed unto him by God. So here's Zophar's points to his friend Job. The life of the wicked will be short on the earth. The pleasure of the wicked will be temporary. And the wicked are going to die hard. They're going to die a painful death. You know, actually, when we studied earlier in the book, Eliphaz had made some of those same points before. So you add up what Zophar has said. You can do the math. This is what happens to the wicked. This is what's happening to you, Job. So what's the conclusion? 2 + 2 = 4. If this is the fate of the wicked, this is what's happening to you. Obviously, you're living in sin, Job. Obviously, you're wicked. So Job responds in chapter 21. And his response in this chapter refutes all three of Zophar's arguments. He refutes them one at a time, but he refutes each one in his response. So at the beginning here, the first few verses, he's going to ask for a little consideration. He says, hear diligently my speech, verse 2, and let this be your consolations. I mean, would you listen carefully, hear diligently? Would you just listen for a change? You're not listening. And it's a point that Job is emphasizing here to his friend Zophar. You're not listening. You know, I do believe that we have a fault, and I won't say it's a universal fault, but it's all too common among us, is that we often don't really listen. We might hear words, but we're not listening. We may not listen, really listen to what's being said. And this is what Job is telling Zophar. You hear words coming out of my mouth, but you're not listening to what I'm telling you. You're not really listening. Husbands and wives have to watch. They don't fall into that, you know, where they just tune each other out. I know that there's noise coming from over there, but I don't know what's being said. But we really do need to listen. This is Job's, his request. And he says, verse 3, suffer me, allow me to speak. And then after I've spoken, you can go ahead and mock me. I mean, that's what you're going to do anyway, you know. That's what he says. But bear with me, listen to me, listen to what I'm saying. And then, you know, after I'm finished, then you can mock me. But, you know, Job can be sarcastic too. You know, if you find it hard to actually be still and be quiet and listen, then he says, look, verse 5, why don't you just put your hand over your mouth just for a little bit? You know, you can be still and quiet long enough to hear me out. That's kind of what he's saying. And verse 4, he says, as for me, is my complaint to man? No, I'm not complaining to you. He said, I'm not complaining about you. My complaint is against God. That's really what he's saying here. I'm complaining to God. You didn't cause me all this agony and pain and misery and suffering. God's what brought that upon me. You didn't make me sick. God's the one who brought that upon me. And even if I did complain to you, you know, you can't blame me, but the idea here is if Job is being impatient, it's because his trial was long, his affliction was severe, his suffering was unimaginable, and his loss was devastating. God's just not answering him. That's what he feels. Look at me, he says in verse 5. Look at me and just be shocked at what you see. Verse 6, he says, even when I remember, when I think about what's happened to me, I tremble, I shake, I shudder. It terrifies me. I'm horrified just thinking about what's come upon me. And in the rest of this chapter, he refutes Zophar's points one at a time. For instance, he says, beginning in verse 7, the wicked don't always die young. Right. I mean, Zophar's point, the wicked, they live a short life. Well, that was Zophar's point. But here's what Job says from verse 7 all the way to verse 16. His point is, the wicked don't always die young. He says, verse 7, wherefore do the wicked live, become old, yea, are mighty in power? How do you account for that? Not only do they live, but they increase. They become mighty in power. If the wicked always die young, why are so many old wicked people on the earth? Here's what one version translates it. Why do evil people live so long and gain such power? Another says, why do evil people live long lives? Why do they grow old and successful? If the wicked die young, how do you account for all these old wicked people?
That's right.
That's That's his point. And he goes on, he says, the fact is, Zophar, the wicked often live long and prosper. They thrive, their herds multiply, they have healthy, happy kids, they enjoy their substance, and when they die quick. They don't die a long, lingering, slow, horrible death like I'm dying. I mean, notice what he says in these verses, beginning in verse 8. I'm going to read this in the New King James Version. I'm going to read beginning in verse 7. Why do the wicked live and become old? Yes, become mighty in power. Their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God upon them. God's not chastening them. Their bull breeds without failure. Their cow calves without miscarriage. They send forth their little ones like a flock. Their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and harp and rejoice to the sound of the flute. They're happy. They're healthy. Their kids are dancing all around. They spend their days in wealth, verse 13, and in a moment go down to the grave. They die a quick, merciful death. How do you account for that, Zophar? Even though, he goes on to say, they leave God completely out of their lives. Verse 14, therefore they say unto God, depart from us, for we desire not the knowledge of thy ways. They've got no use for God, no love for God, no desire to know God. They don't want to hear about God. What do you have to offer them? That's exactly what he's talking about here. What do you have to offer them? Who's God? What's he going to do for us? What's your God going to do? Is he going to make us happy? We're happy. What is your God going to do? Is he going to make us prosper? We're prosperous. Is he going to make us healthy? We're healthy. Why do I need your God? You serve him and look at you. You're sick. You're heavy laden with burdens. Hardly getting by. Maybe your God's not so great. I mean, that's the attitude of the rich, right? Verse 14, they say unto God, depart from us. We desire not the knowledge of thy ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit should we have if we pray to him? What's he going to do for us? I read something about two guys. It was a pastor of the church, and he was taking one of the deacons with him, and they were going through neighborhoods talking to people about the Lord. And they came to this house where you had to walk through this iron gate, long circular driveway, very elegant, beautiful, flowers everywhere, big, huge manicured grounds. As he walks up the manicured driveway, they see Rolls Royce parked in the driveway. They see other exotic cars parked in the driveway. They look at this gigantic, enormous house. They see children swimming in the swimming pool in the backyard and laughing and cutting up. They see through the window the guy sitting inside his house. He's got his TVs playing and he's got music on and he's drinking his highball. And the deacon looks at him and looks at the pastor and he says, tell me again, what's the good news we have for this guy? Well, you see, when you're very short-sighted, you would think this guy's got everything. This guy needs nothing. And that's what they think. They have everything. I've got everything I could want. Of course, you and I know that behind many a fine door, there's a lot of misery and sadness and pain and sorrow. There's a lot of empty lives behind many a fine, fine door. But Job is making a point here. And the point is, you can't make this generalization that the wicked die young, because it's not always true. They often live long lives, and not only do they live long, they thrive. they prosper. And you can look at them. I do believe that the wicked are miserable, but you know, they don't think they're miserable. They think they're very happy. And what profit would we have, verse 15, if we should pray unto the Lord? Now, Job says in the next verse, verse 16, they don't know that they didn't make themselves rich. They think they did. They think they pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps. But we know that whatever they have, God gave them. Verse 16, lo, their good is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. They don't know that God blessed them, despite their wickedness. And Job says, their counsel is far from me. That is, I don't believe what they believe. They think they prospered themselves. But Job knew that every good and precious gift is from above, right? From the Father of lights, to whom is no variableness, nor shadow of turning. But here's Job's point to his friend. How can you classify me as wicked? Because this is what Zophar was saying in plain language. You know, you're wicked because these things happen to the wicked, therefore you're wicked. How can you classify me as wicked? I know that evil people don't make their own success. I know that whatever we have from the hand of God. I would never follow their advice. I would not embrace their philosophy of life. But Job's point to Zophar, the wicked don't always die young. Sometimes they do, but sometimes righteous people die young too. Good people die young, not just evil people. Here's the second refutation of Zophar's argument. Job says the wicked don't always suffer calamity either. They don't. They don't always have a miserable life. They sometimes do very well. I might remind you of something Bildad had said back in chapter 18. He said, the lamp of the wicked will be put out. The idea is calamity would strike them. Well, notice verse 17. He says, how often is the candle of the wicked put out? How often? How often comes their destruction upon them? God distributeth sorrows in his anger. So here's his question. You said that the wicked are smitten for their sins, that God deals with them, smites them. And here's his question. How often do you see that happen? When's the last time you saw somebody blaspheme God and then get struck by lightning? When's the last time you saw that happen? This is Job's response. Now, remember, he's responding to Zophar. So, when's the last time you saw a person who sinned or blasphemed or mocked God or cursed God or dared God or defied God and then was smitten down in divine wrath? I know there's times I kind of think I'd like to see that happen, but the fact of the matter is God's much more long-suffering than we are, right? There's a passage over in Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11. It says, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. So because they're not judged immediately for their sins, they are confirmed in their sins. They're not judged immediately for what they do. Go ahead, Dave.
So what they're saying is, so far, so good.
That's a Dave joke. But I like it. So how often do you actually see God's anger and God's wrath demonstrated towards the godless? How often do you see that? The fact is, we don't see that very often. Verse 18, they are as stubble before the wind and as chaff that the storm carries away. Do you see the wicked wind blown like straw, carried away like chaff in a hurricane? Not really. You don't really see that very often. We know God does judge the wicked. But Job is answering Zophar's flawed argument. And verse 19, another answer to some of their arguments. God lays up his iniquity for his children and rewards him, and he shall know it. Here's the idea. Will God judge the child of the wicked person instead? You know, in chapter 20 and verse 10, Zophar had said, even if God didn't judge the wicked, he'd judge their children. He'd surely judge their children. You know, he'd cause them to lose everything that they had and so forth. Of course, he's pointing to Job, you know, God judged you, but he also judged your children. But here's Job's response. Well, the wicked person would be dead and gone by then. And so if God judged his children, the wicked person would never know that he was judged at all. It doesn't make any sense. The argument's flawed. He would never know that punishment came. Y'all follow me? Well, that's kind of the argument here. Verse 20, he says, let the wicked see their punishment. Let them experience the wrath of the Almighty themselves. Let them taste the cup of divine fury. Nothing less than that would be just. That's his argument. Verse 21, because once he's dead, he won't care about his house, his children, his whatever he left behind. How can he be interested in all that after he's gone? When he's dead, he will have no knowledge of any of those things. I'm kind of giving you the Brother Rusty paraphrase here, if that's okay. That's verse 21. What pleasure has he in his house after him? Like, once he's dead, I mean, he's not going to get any happiness out of knowing that his children have all this wealth, and he won't get any sadness out of thinking that they lost it all. He's dead. That's his point. Once he's dead, he's gone. So, remember, Job is one at a time refuting Zophar's accusations. Zophar said the wicked will die young. Job said not always. Zophar said the pleasures of the wicked are temporary, you know, because God's going to smite them. Job said, well, when did you ever see that happen? He said, I've seen the wicked prosper. I've seen them live long. But then the third argument that Zophar made was that the wicked will die hard. They'll die a hard death. They will die a terrible, painful death. And here's what Job said in answering Zophar. He said the wicked die just like everybody else. Beginning in verse 22, shall any teach God knowledge, seeing that he judges those that are high? One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and quiet. His breasts are full of milk. His bones are moistened with marrow. The wicked die like everybody else dies. Some die young. Some die old. Some die whether they're educated or illiterate, whether they're famous or unknown, whether they're slave or free. Some die quick. Some die slow. They die just like everybody else dies. And his question in verse 22 is, can you teach God how to govern the world? I mean, is that what you're thinking? Because Zophar, that's what you're doing. Zophar, that's what you're doing. You are presuming to tell God what he can and can't do. You're saying he can't afflict the righteous. You're saying he can't prosper the wicked. You're saying that he's got to give long life to those who are good, and he can't shorten the life of the good. You can't give long life to the wicked. You know, God's sovereign. He can do what he wants. The New King James in verse 23 says, one dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and secure. His pails are full of milk. The marrow of his bones is moist. Verse 25, others die in poverty. Another dies in the bitterness of his soul and never eateth with pleasure. Some people just live hard lives and never really do have a chance to enjoy nice things, comfortable things, a comfortable lifestyle. But you can be sure of this one thing, verse 26, they all die. They shall lie down alike in the dust, and the worms shall cover them, rich or poor, black or white, male or female, educated, illiterate, good, evil, everybody dies. That's his point, everybody dies. And of course, Job is speaking of life in this world. He's not here talking about eternity or matters of eternity. Just the fact that everybody dies alike. Some die slow, some die quick. You can't make these rash generalizations. And he goes on in the next verses and he says, look, I know your thoughts, verse 27. I know what you're thinking and the devices you wrongfully imagine against you. Against me. You say, where's the house of the prince? Where's the dwelling of the wicked? Here's an interesting thing Job is saying. I already know what you're going to say. Job's already anticipating their rebuttal. He says, you're going to say, show me the house of a righteous person, and then show me the tent of a wicked person. And, you know, generally, I think you could make a general point that a good, righteous person will be blessed. There's a general point you can make there. And that a wicked person, that many times you look at where they live and how they live, and it reflects. But that's certainly a rash generalization. And Job's, he's thinking about what they're going to say already. But notice his response here. Have you not asked them that go by the way? Do you not know their tokens or their evidence? Do you ever talk to people who have a broader experience than you? Job is saying, your experience is too limited. You're basing your thinking just on your limited experience. But talk to people who have a broader experience, and they will tell you, wicked people often live long lives. Wicked people often live very well. You need a broader experience. Your perspective is too narrow. That's what he's saying. But in every part of the world, you will see what Job's saying, that what I'm saying is true. Verse 30, he says that the wicked is reserved to the day of destruction. They'll be brought forth to the day of wrath. Obviously, Job believed in a future punishment for the wicked and a reward for the righteous. He believed that. He says, verse 31, who shall declare his way to his face? Who shall repay him what he's done? This is kind of an interesting question here. He makes an interesting argument. If you're certain that the wicked are going to suffer terribly for their sins, if you're certain that they're going to be smitten down in the prime of life, if you're certain that they're going to die hard, that they're going to lose everything, then here's his question, verse 31, have you warned them to their face? Have you warned them? Will you condemn them or criticize them to their face? You know they're heading to certain death and destruction. You know that there's no escape. He says, yet shall he be brought to the grave and shall remain in the tomb. He's going to a place he will not return from. He was wicked. You didn't rebuke him. That's what he's saying. Here I am. I'm not wicked. And you don't stop rebuking me. I'm righteous. You rebuke me. They're wicked. You don't rebuke them. Job's pointing out their inconsistencies here, you see. He says, verse 33, the clods of the valley shall be sweet unto him. They're heading for the grave. They'll be buried in honors. And he talks about how multitudes of others are going to follow their wicked example. Every man will draw after him as there are innumerable before him. People are following the wicked into a life of wickedness. Verse 34, you comfort me in vain. Seeing in your answers there remains falsehood. He's wicked, you didn't rebuke him. I'm righteous, you rebuke me. Your comfort is not comfortable. Your wisdom is false. That's his point. Your empty words are no comfort to me. There's no truth in your answers. I think Job had a good refutation of Zophar's arguments. And we'll leave it there. They were miserable comforters all. They had a preacher that that said one time that he had a fella in his congregation that always prayed. His prayer was, God, help me today to not add to somebody's burden. I think that's a good thing to pray. Don't add to somebody's burden. Go ahead, brother.
I hope in the Hebrew this is poetic, but I sure don't see the poetry in English.
No, you won't see it in the English. And Hebrew poetry is a lot different than English poetry anyway. Doesn't really have rhyme and doesn't have meter the way we think of poetry. You know, our poetry is not at all like theirs. But nevertheless, it is a book of poetry, and that makes it a little bit difficult. Because, you know, reading poetry is a challenge in any language. But unless it's, you know, there was a young lady from Niger who rode on the back of a tiger, you know, that kind of poetry. Well, Father, bless, I pray, our understanding of these passages. I do pray that you help us to recognize that while death comes alike to the righteous and the wicked, and while calamity can befall any and all, Lord, our hope and our trust is in you, that you protect and preserve, that you keep us from the evil, and Lord, that you do bless us with health and longevity. Lord, our prayer is your blessing upon each of our houses, our families, our minds, our hearts. Lord, fill our souls with your peace. Lord, let us know the power of your presence. Let us know, Lord, that you are for us and with us, and that never would you abandon us. Let us know, Lord Jesus, the comforts of your presence and the security of your protection. And Lord, for all of your blessings, for all of your provision, and for all that you've bestowed upon us, all the great favor that you've bestowed upon us, we give you thanks. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Well, thank you for your attention. I pray that you men will be able to be here Saturday morning at 7:30 for the men.